Hawks fans, wherever you may be, welcome inside the Hawks Playbook Podcast. Join your host, Bill Alfstead, and featuring Seahawks sports writer and football analyst, Keith Myers.
Hello, and welcome into the Hawks Playbook Podcast. This week's show covers the big win in the Big Apple. I am Bill Alfstead, your host, and here with co-host Keith Myers, also football editor and writer extraordinaire. Mr. Myers, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm here. I've got my coffee. I'm awake. I'm ready.
I know. You know, we could start this really, really early and just be done with it by the time, you know, all the kids need to go to school and all that stuff. We'd have our complete day to just completely mess around on Twitter.
True, and we'd be really boring because all you'd have is me is like drooling on the microphone. So
that's funny. And you actually have a beer called Moose Drool, don't you?
I have one called Caribou Slobber, which is
Caribou Slobber. Okay, Moose Drool, Caribou Slobber. You can understand how I would get confused.
Caribou Slobber is a clone of Moose Drool. Moose Drool is a commercially available beer.
Okay, that's where I'm at fault. Sorry. I would not want to confuse your beer with a commercially available beer.
They're so, both good, so whatever.
Yeah, they are. I don't think I've tried the Moose Drool, though. I've tried yours, and yours was fantastic. So, in this week's show, we're going to go over the game. We've got a lot to talk about in that respect. About halfway through or three-quarters through, we're going to queue up the Texans game coming up at home against the Seahawks this week. And but first, before we get to all that, we've just got a couple of tidbits to talk about in the news. Looks like the Seahawks are looking at bringing in Dwight Freeney for a look, possibly a medical exam, just to kind of see where he's at and see if he would be a good situational pass rusher for the Seahawks moving forward for the next 10 games. What do you think?
Well, I think that he is historically one of the best pass rushers of all time, but I'm not sure how much he's got left in the tank. That's why he's out there. He's, you know, getting pretty old, but you know, they're losing Cliff Avril, and they've replaced Cliff Avril's starting position with Frank Clark, which has not been a downgrade in any way. But they need someone who can come in for 10 to 15 snaps a game on obvious passing situations, get after the quarterback, and give guys like Frank Clark or Michael Bennett a rest, because those guys can't play 100% of the snaps. And, you know, it comes down to money and, you know, how much he's got left in the tank, but
I don't think they're going to know.
Pedigree.
I don't think they're going to know how much he's got left in the tank until he steps on the field and tries it out. I mean, that's the problem with these sort of things. He hasn't played since he was since his last game, which was last year. So I'm not sure. I mean, to me, and I'll talk about this a little bit later in the show too, we've got a guy, Brandon Jackson, that's came on to the team recently. And when given the opportunity, he's played well and showed very well. And I would be way more interested, I think, in developing that prospect just from a cost value standpoint for the franchise. What do you think?
Well, I don't.
Or are they two different players?
They are. I mean, they are. But there's room for both on the roster and in the rotation. To me, what it comes down to is: are you willing to go, you know, look at this season and say, well, what happens if Bennett or Clark gets hurt, and you need another pass rusher? Are you comfortable with going with Jackson as the guy? And you know, this is a Super Bowl team, at least one that wants to go in that route. Are you willing to take your pass rush and put it in the hands of this unknown guy
Team? Give it to a guy who had 3 sacks and 16 starts for the, you know, last time he played?
True, but he only played, you know, a few snaps per game. Because of his age. So they let him start because he's got a name and he's Dwight Freeney and you know, he's a Hall of Famer when he finally hangs him up. But they didn't play him that much. He came, he would start, but he was playing 10 to 15 snaps a game. So it wasn't a situation where he was all over the place.
Let me ask you this. So we could have a situation. Let's say we sign Freeney. Let's say we find a way to keep Brandon Jackson. So that's filling a roster spot that exists currently, so we don't have to release anybody, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Agreed.
So what happens then if, say, a Shed comes back or Malik McDowell is available and is added to the roster? What kind of moves do you see the team having to make in order to accommodate the addition of those players? Or do you think Dwight Freeney then becomes one of those guys that they may just toss?
Well, I think we're in a position where you make the move for now and then worry about the other thing when it happens. Because when Shed, McDowell, Deion Jordan, when those guys become available, the Seahawks will be given a roster exemption for them for 2 weeks. So that you still have two more weeks before you have to make that decision. And then you just wait, because there's a good chance. It's football. It's the NFL. Somebody's going to get hurt between now and then. And, well, there's your roster spot, because you could just deal with it that way.
So another intriguing player came up in the news this morning as being available. Byron Maxwell, former Seattle Seahawks defensive back, released by the Dolphins. Just didn't work out anywhere other than Seattle for that guy. So the logical thinking in Seahawks land is, well, if it worked out before, it could work out again. Byron Maxwell is available. He doesn't have to clear waivers. What do you think?
I don't think that it works for Seattle, because I don't think that you have need, cap space, room on the roster. You have Jeremy Lane coming back from injury. You have Shed coming back from injury. You really
it's
don't
pretty loaded
need,
back there. Yeah.
Yeah. This it's so good. It's such a good position group for Seattle already. And then you're bringing in a guy who has had.
Would you give up Nico Thorpe for Byron Mack? I know that Nico is primarily special teams. Right, but would you give a roster spot up to get Maxwell on the team?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't. And it's partly because he's had one good year since leaving Seattle, and that would be last year in Miami. But even that year in Miami didn't get him any leeway with that coaching staff. Like they benched him quickly and now cut him. I mean, even after having a good year. So it's, to me, you look at that and you go, okay, what does Miami know that we as fans don't know?
Sure.
How much of his good year was it just not as good as we thought?
Let me ask you this. He was okay in Seattle, but mm-hmm. Seattle let him go. Did not choose to sign him to a multi-million dollar contract when he did leave. Seattle passed for a reason. And those reasons would still seem to make sense to me for the contract that he was able to get. But at this point, 10 games to go in a season, seems to me that Byron Maxwell will be probably willing to come back for the veteran minimum, I would think, unless he's looking for a 2 or 3 year deal out there that some team might give him to make sure that they retain his rights after this season. But logically, he could probably play for somebody for the remainder of the year and become a free agent in the offseason. I don't know. I mean, it seemed like it would be a good fit in Seattle. He's already been here. He does well. He gets along with all the players. He's one of the, not a founding member of the Legion of Boom, but he was the second generation Legion of Boom member. It seems like it could work for the right price, but I don't know what you would have to give up to do it. So that's the hesitation.
Well, part of the reason why I just don't even think it's an option, despite the fact that Seattle fans will really want it to happen, is that the Seahawks are not going to be able to compete with either of the Bay Area teams as far as financially and in terms of need playing time, because both Oakland and San Francisco run a version of Seattle's defense schematically. Both of them are desperately in need of cornerback help, and it just makes way more sense that he's going to end up on one of those rosters.
True. And maybe, but maybe he's at a point in his career where he wants to play for a contender again. It'll be interesting to see where he ends up landing. Couple other things. I just wanted to briefly talk about, before the, we get into the meat and potatoes of the show, talk about the situation with Doug Baldwin where he kind of shoved Cable on the sideline. We kind of didn't see the entirety of the lead up to that moment, and then it kind of broke away before it was completely finished. So we don't really know firsthand all the details. We just know that Doug Baldwin came out and apologized, accepted 100% responsibility. Pete Carroll came out and said, I put him in a bad situation. And so, and it really stemmed from the fact that, Baldwin wanted to allow Wilson to have a leadership moment with the offense. And then Cable was going to come over and started talking over that and interrupted what was happening. And so, Baldwin in the heat of the moment just kind of let his passion get away from him. But I probably don't think that you didn't really mind the shove.
Me personally, no, not one bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but you gotta. There's somebody needs to step up within the team and, you know, make Tom Cable be accountable for some of the decisions he's made and some of the play by his group and his unit and that kind of thing. And if Baldwin's the guy who's going to do that, fine. Let's do that. I agree.
I don't think it was that big of a deal, but it did ignite the team, you know. And to me, that showed just how much of a leader Baldwin really is. Now, some people may not agree with the tactic there, but it was highly effective, and he's been effective in other ways as well. And it seems to me this is. Bobby, I was just going to say Bobby Ingram. This is Doug Baldwin's team. You know, I mean, you can say it's Russell Wilson's team, but man, Doug Baldwin is the heart and soul.
Well, he is trying. I don't know if he's trying, but or if he just is naturally doing this, but he is kind of stepping into a role that Marshawn Lynch reluctantly had in the past, where he's trying to be a tone setter. He's trying to be an igniter, a guy who, the team feeds off of. And that was Lynch. It was Lynch in the past, but it wasn't Lynch through leadership and sideline antics and whatever. It was just because he would go out there and literally run people over, and it just fired everybody up. Where now they don't have that aspect. So, you know, Doug's out there and he's jumping up and down and he's making noise and he's making huge, impactful plays for the team and getting everybody fired up. So it's a needed element to Seattle's roster, and he's fulfilling that part of it.
I have one more little tidbit headline. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The Seahawks ran a traditional screenplay this last game. And it was successful, except for Rawls outran his blocking.
Yeah, he left a lot of yards on the field there.
That was a well-designed play. And, you know, just looking at a play like that, it seems like that would work a lot in with our offense, because our line is so porous anyway.
Yeah, the defenders are used to getting into the backfield quickly, so they don't tend to notice that it's
that they're just automatically being allowed to come in. Yeah,
yeah. They don't notice that it's on purpose that they're not blocked, and so therefore they do what they're supposed to do and get beat. The problem with it, and the reason why Seattle doesn't run it much, is that this is a Russell Wilson issue. He has a hard time getting the ball to the running back because he has to throw it up over the top of the defenders a little bit. And it's just not where his skill set is best. Although they actually ran the play twice, slightly different versions of it, but they ran it twice. One went for a lot of yards, although Rawls made it less effective than it could have been. And the other one, God, there was a lot of real estate in front of him again, and Rawls just flat dropped it.
Yeah.
So
there were a few drops in this game that were aggravating. I mean, that Jimmy Graham drop on the sideline, he had nobody within 25 yards of him.
Oh, yeah. He catches that, and he's got the free safety, which will meet him about the 3-yard line.
Yeah.
And
good luck, right?
And, you know, just who wins that collision, whether or not it's a touchdown or whether the ball's at the one, right? So, that's how open he was, and he just flat dropped it. It hit him in the hands.
What do you think about Jimmy Graham in this game? In fact, the whole season's just been like this, where he's dropped a couple, and then he's come back and redeemed himself. He can't put it all together, though. I mean, he's had maybe one complete game where I think everything pretty well went his way, but everything else has been really hit and miss, and the misses are really bad, and the timing is really crappy, and we need his yardage, and you know, he has plays like that. And then at other times, he's picking up real good chunks of yardage and making plays and running over people. And I just don't know what to make of him this year.
Yeah, it's very frustrating because he had a touchdown. So it's like, it's not like he was doing nothing. I mean, he had a key touchdown in this game. He also dropped
a key touchdown. Right in his basket. Right in his basket.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, the ball was a little low. I think he was expecting it high and it came low. So there, you know, it's not like it wasn't a perfect pass or anything, but it was fourth down. You make that play. Just make the play. Just catch the ball. Get the touchdown. This is it was a very different game throughout. If he catches either of those two passes.
Yeah. And you could say that on a number of different plays. I mean, Russell Wilson also had a couple of overthrows that would have accounted for about 150 yards and a couple of other TDs. I mean, Wilson could have had a monster game. I mean, monstrous, like close to 500 yards and five TDs. Monstrous.
Yeah. He overthrew Doug Baldwin on one where Baldwin was 10 yards beyond the last defender. I mean, if Wilson throws at about 2 yards shorter, it's
a home run.
Oh man, it's just a beautiful pass catch touchdown. And then there was another one to Tyler Lockett, which very similar, just a little bit too far. And it's weird because usually Wilson's very good with those kind of throws, but this year he's overthrown quite a few of them. So yeah. I don't know if there's, you know, just something a little off or he's just not seeing it well or
yeah, in
or
the what's past, he's had a lot more precision and it seems like he's just chucking them this year. It seems like he's kind of one of those things where I can imagine he's looking at the spot he thinks he's going to throw to and he just closes his eyes and he just chucks it, you know, as opposed to just really taking the time and just dropping it in there like he should. I don't know. Nonetheless, you can't take anything away from Russell Wilson in this game. He was lights out crazy, 375 yards, three TDs, 121 passer rating. A lot to like in this game with Russell Wilson. Even in the first quarter, second quarter, where we were still moving the ball. I mean, we moved the ball 222 yards in the first half and only came away with 3 points.
I mean, a lot of that is because of the one drive, right? There they had a 16-play drive, got down to the goal line, had 10 shots to punch it in, and
We had like 12 plays inside the 16-yard line.
Yeah, 10 plays points. Inside the 10, zero points. And that's painful because you had, in that section, you had a couple of runs get stuffed because there's no run blocking. You had the Jimmy Graham drop. You had the fade pattern to Jimmy Graham where Graham was turning inside and the ball went outside and he had to like
and turn he would have, and if come that back was out. A good catch or a good throw, it would have been a touchdown.
Well, I don't know if it was not a good throw or if it was not a good route because you have Graham turning inside when all that space was on the outside and that's why Wilson threw it out there was to the to the space in the corner. If Graham turns the other way and looks back over his other shoulder and peels outside like you're supposed to, that's just a drop in the bucket for him, and it's an easy touchdown. So I don't know if it was a bad throw. I think it was a bad route on that case. But it was just such poor execution. Like I know people are talking about, you know, for some reason Seattle fans just love to talk about the play calling, but there were. Of those 10 plays, you know, two of them were penalties. That's why they got 10 plays inside the 10. But there were probably four or five touchdowns to be scored had players just executed. If Jimmy Graham catches either of those, or if, you know, guy makes a block on a, on the running plays, there are plays to be made, and they just weren't being made. Yeah,
Obushi had a horrific play down there where Lacey was slammed 2 feet behind the line of scrimmage on a goal line play. I mean, mm-hmm. really?
And that's, he's just standing there watching the guy that he lined up against.
I don't even understand. I mean, it's just looking at it. It was like, what were you thinking? I mean, and who's making that line call, you know, and what are you guys communicating? I mean, it's just that sort of thing is really frustrating for me, because those are all things that this team at this point in the season should have completely down 100%.
I agree. It's one of those things where you look at and you go, to me, it's hard to tell, but just based on everyone's reaction, it just looked like Obushi just got beat. Like, whether he was off balance, whether he didn't anticipate the snap count, and the defender moved and was in position before Obushi did, but he just got beat one-on-one and just completely whiffed on a goal line play. So you're only blocking the guy right in front of you, and you can't have that. It was pretty bad.
So really there's only one other bad thing about the entire day, and then everything else is going to be positive that we talk about, I think, for the most part. CJ Procise tweaks his ankle on his second play versus the Giants, and he's out again.
It was his second play?
I think I read now that they clarified. At first it was he was only in for one play and hurt his ankle. He was in for two plays, hurt his ankle.
See, here's the thing, is that we got the announcement that he had hurt his ankle, was questionable to return, which meant he wasn't going to return. I hadn't even noticed him in the game. I thought, well, maybe he was in on a special teams play and tweaked his ankle. I'm like, what is going on with this guy? And it's very, very frustrating.
I don't know even what to say, because he's a great talent, but he's just going to be one of those guys that can never see the field, you know, and at some point the Seahawks will have to move on from him, because they can't afford to have a guy like that on the roster.
Yeah, he's taken up a roster spot, and, you know, basically they had to play the game with a 45-man roster instead of a 46-man roster, because there's a guy that was not really expected to play, but kind of at the last second got himself active and then lasted apparently two plays. And then was gone for the rest of the game.
So didn't you say something on Twitter about it where, like, you know, Seattle's going to release him and he's going to go on to play for somebody else and never be injured again or something like that?
Well, that's just Seattle luck, right? I mean, it's more Mariners luck than Seahawks luck. But that's how it works with injuries in Seattle, is guys like this, they're just completely... Well, look at Russell Okung. How's that for a good example? I mean, he was always hurt, just always being stepped on, tweaking his ankles, never available for 16 games. He leaves Seattle, plays all 16 games for Denver, hasn't been hurt in San Diego. I mean, it's just the way it works for Seattle fans.
So I think this week, it seems like every week we've kind of been paying more attention to the offense than the defense. I want to do the opposite today. I want to start with the defense.
Absolutely. This was an incredible defensive performance by the Seahawks.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, there were all sorts of stats that pointed in Seattle's favor in this game. But, you know, Seattle's now, again, the number one scoring defense. The only TD that Seattle allowed was on that Thomas Rawls fumble recovery at the 17-yard line. They threw it in on a missed assignment in the end zone. Other than that, the Seahawks just played so tight. I mean, we only allowed 177 total yards. The Giants never gained any more than 20 yards on any possession until the fourth quarter. So it's good. It's really good.
Eli Manning had 17 passing yards in the first half.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's
17.
That's not bad for Seattle's defense, is it?
Not at all. Now, part of that, when Seattle's defense is putting together performances that are statistically just crazy.
Yeah.
Part of it is the offense had that 16 play drive that lasted almost 8 minutes, gave the defense a nice rest. The defense was fresh throughout the entire game. They weren't out there just, you know, getting tired and getting run down, which is what's happened in other games this year. And when that defense gets a chance to just pin its ears back and go after a quarterback and be fresh in doing it, wow, it's just what a fun game to watch. I mean, that was just crazy good.
Well, and it's in this time of the year game, you know, seventh week, eighth week in the season, you're now able to kind of see the trends, see where the team's going to be. And we're going to be a number one defense. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I mean, Seattle's defense outside of, say, the Titans game has allowed just over 12 points a game and 280 yards. And they've not allowed more than 18 points in any of the other five games.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that Titans game was definitely an aberration.
Right. So now you can say that. Now you can say, you know what? Maybe the Titans game, that was the heat, it was the travel, it was whatever. Because on any given day, in fact, I think if they play the Titans at home, they beat the Titans. You know, it's just one of those deals where sometimes things just don't line up. But everything else, I mean, Richard Sherman. Talk about Richard Sherman for a half a second. Over the last three games, he's had 10 targets. Two catches allowed, 17 yards allowed, and two pass breakups. And they just aren't even throwing to him. They just aren't. That's three games worth of, you know, probably 120 passes against our defense because teams need to throw against us to try to beat us. So there's a lot of passing attempts. And our secondary is just the best in the NFL. It just is.
Yep.
And Richard Sherman's still at the top of his game.
Yeah, and you look at that, and there are times in that stretch, I mean, not this week, but in that three-game stretch where the pass rush wasn't getting to the quarterback. But you still have, so the quarterback's got time. They've got the ability to step up and step into their throws, and they're still not completing passes to Sherman's guy. Yeah. And that just tells you how sticky he's been in coverage and how good. It's been a really fun film to watch when I get it, you know, when the All 22 comes out and I go back and watch. When the Seahawks are on defense, I tend to ignore Sherman when I'm doing my film study because I know he's good. I don't have to, like, watch. But then it's kind of fun to go back and re-watch again and just watch him. Or just him and Earl Thomas, because if you're watching in the back line. And both of those guys are so special. They're so much
fun. All pros. All pros. Not just Pro Bowlers. All pros. Yes. And then Shaq Griffin. I mean, in this game, Shaq Griffin had seven targets and allowed three receptions for 17 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And Coleman is playing really well. I don't even know how Lane can get back on the field.
Yeah. Coleman has stepped up and has been much better, much quicker than I think we all expected.
And I noticed he had a little swagger to him in this last game.
Yeah, he was hitting guys, and he, you know, would bounce up and, you know, have that little celebration, and he was really into it, really emotional, and that's good to see because he's a guy who joined the team for week one, wasn't here during training camp.
Right.
He's kind of learning the Legion of Boom thing as he goes, and as he's learning the system, because he, you know, they came from a very different defensive system in New England before the Seahawks traded for him. So he's having to learn, having to adjust. But man, he looks like he's just flying around out there and playing well.
You know, and the really cool thing about all of this, just not the Giants game, is that Seattle's played four of its first six games on the road. Mm-hmm. And it's 4-2 out of that. And they've got the next
two in a row.
Two in a row at home, and the next six out of the last 10 of the season at home.
Yep.
It lines up real favorable for us. I mean, I would be disappointed now. We always talk about maybe readjusting our expectations. I would be disappointed if we didn't see 11 wins out of this team. And possibly it's still 12. I mean, it's still possible if we can
unroll here. It's definitely possible. If the offense stops shooting itself in the foot and executes the way that it did in the second half, and really the way it did between the 20s in the first half, there's no reason to think that this team won't just run up a whole bunch of wins.
Well, I was going to save the schedule for a little later because I was going to talk about the remaining games, but let's do it right now. So we've got Houston at home,
mm-hmm.
And then Washington at home. Okay, so Houston is a 3-3 team.
I think they're better than their record suggests.
They're better than because they've lost against teams that they probably should have lost against, and they've beaten teams they probably should have won. Mm-hmm. They're a 3-3 team, but they could possibly be 4-2. They've had a couple of close games if you look at their scores. The Washington game, we should take care of business, no problem there. At Arizona, Arizona is just not a good NFL team right now, and they lost Carson Palmer for the year. They're even worse than they were. Atlanta at home, that's going to be a really key game. That's an ESPN game on a Monday night. That's going to be an outstanding game, I think. But I think that we take care of business against Atlanta. I mean, there's no reason that I don't think that we should. We're at San Francisco. I think that's a close game in the first half, and we pull away in the second half. Philadelphia at home. Philadelphia had a really bad injury this week to Peters, their left tackle. Looks like he's going to be done for the year.
Yep, ACL and MCL injury was reported this morning.
That's real tough. And then at Jacksonville looks to be a lot tougher of a game at this point than it did at the beginning of the season when we made our predictions. It looks like they could definitely lead the league in sacks this year. They've got a really good defensive front.
They had 11 sacks this week. 11 in one game. There are teams that are right around 11 sacks on the year. Yeah. As a team, they had 11 sacks in one game. That's impressive. I mean, that's Calais Campbell making everybody else on that line better is what that is.
Well, the only good news out of that thing is it is on the road, and it's December 10th. So the alternative could be a really wet, soggy game in Seattle. I'd prefer that, but they'll be playing in the probable sunshine against Jacksonville. I'm not sure about that game. You know, I think you could probably take a team like that and use the aggressiveness on their line against them, and I think Seattle will do that. The LA Rams.
There's also the Blake Bortles effect in that game.
Yeah, and we beat up bad quarterbacks. We just do.
Yep, and so when you have good teams with bad quarterbacks, that tends to go against certain teams because the talent level wins out even with the bad quarterback. But against Seattle, their defense is so good. The bad quarterback play, I think, will be a deciding factor. But
yeah, that's still 6 weeks away, so yep. We'll have time to figure that out. LA Rams at home, that's going to be ends up being a key division battle and conference battle. That Rams game. Rams are just better than anybody thought that they would be, but they still have Jared Goff as quarterback. And I don't think Jared Goff is as good as people, as the team's record would dictate that he is. I think he's got some susceptibilities there. I think he likes to wing it. I think he's susceptible to interceptions and mistakes. But it's at home, so I see Seattle winning that game. At Dallas, Dallas doesn't look as formidable as they may have been at the beginning of the season, but they could come on, you never know. And then finishing out at home against Arizona. I still look at that schedule right there, and I could say, yeah, we could lose a couple of those games, but other than that, we should be favored in every one of them.
The only one would be possibly Philly. That's the one that I think.
That's at home, though, on Monday night. What's our record on primetime games, Keith, in the Pete Carroll era?
Forget the Pete Carroll era. Look at it from historically.
Well, historically,
the Seahawks are the best Monday night team.
I think Pete's like 12-1 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So what was your earlier statement about Philadelphia?
I would say that's going to be the only one. Well, the thing is, I said that there is probably the one game where they're going to be Seahawks are going to be underdogs just because.
No, say that out loud, Keith.
you got to remember that being underdogs.
So you've got to tell me
betting and not has Houston, to do with what's going on in the field.
If we beat Washington, if we beat Arizona, and we beat Atlanta, and we beat San Francisco, we're going to be underdogs against Philadelphia. What?
Okay, you're talking about them Seahawks going in on an 8-game win streak. You're right, they won't be. But do you expect them to be on an 8-game win streak going into that game?
I don't expect them to lose more than one of the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 games.
Yeah, so But yeah, so they're going to lose a game in there. And I think that that's going to change the way people look at it. And
so they would be coming in at 7-1.
What?
So they would be 7-1 over their last 8 games. So that would change the perspective
a little bit, because you, when you don't have that like run, because you got to remember that when we talk about underdogs, that's about betting and that's about perception. And you're talking, the lines are set in order to manipulate the bets that are made. Not, they're not predictions about who's going to win. They're about manipulating the bet. And so when you have, it's all about perceptions, and it's all about the fact that you have this classic NFC East power. And those teams tend to get bet more heavily on. And so, yeah, it's about that kind of stuff. So when you factor all of that in, I do think that unless Philly takes this, you know, a turn and comes back down to earth a bit, you're going to see Seattle probably be an underdog in that game.
So getting back to right now, with the team, let me just run a couple players by you and you give me some instant feedback. Riso Diombo.
He is continuing to struggle. I think he is what he is.
He allowed one pressure, though, in 42 dropbacks in against the Giants.
True, but the Giants didn't line Jason Pierre-Paul up against him, and when they did, the Seahawks countered with a tight end. So they were double teaming him, and it's really a matter of the fact that the Giants just don't have a great front seven outside of Jason Pierre-Paul.
Ethan Posick.
I was actually impressed. He came in, he played every other series at left guard, and then for what was it, 3 plays when Justin Britt was out, he played center for those 3 snaps.
Should he be the starting left guard for the Seattle Seahawks?
He should be until Luke Jokel comes back.
Yeah. Golowinski had a pretty decent game. I mean, he only allowed a pressure as well. One pressure, no sacks.
Yeah. Both of them actually played really well. And I was surprised that the Seahawks were able to get such a good performance out of 2 different guys at the same position with the way that they're rotating and all that kind of stuff. Now,
well, it is the Giants.
Yep. Now, to me, I look at pass blocking, and that's kind of what I was looking at. I mean, both of them I thought played well. There were some problems in the run blocking,
yeah, not getting to
the second level, whiffing guys at the second level. And I thought Posick was better at blocking in space than Golowinski was. And that's the reason why I'd say put stick Posick in there as the starter until Luke Jokel comes back.
So, and I didn't write it down anywhere, but off the top of your head, how do we do in the run game this game? Do you know what we finished at and stuff?
Well, I can tell you that Rawls and Lacey both had 11 attempts. Rawls had 36 yards. Lacey had 34. That's not going to cut it by either guy. So that's 22
and that's in
rushes.
And that's a game that we won 24-7. And granted, yeah, we didn't pile up those points until, you know, midway through the third and fourth quarters, but...
No, but they had that 16-play drive in the second quarter, and they were able to move the ball in the first half, even though they didn't score points. But they had 22 carries. That's a lot of carries. So if you think about, like, if Marshawn Lynch ever had 22 carries in a game, what would we expect? We'd expect him to be at 125 yards, you know, 130 yards, somewhere in there. And Seattle's running backs had 70. Yeah. 70 out of those 22 carries. It's just not enough. They're just not. The running game just isn't there.
What do you think about using McKissick a little bit more? I mean, he had some touches, but it seems like they could use him a little bit more in the game to kind of spread it out a little bit.
Well, he had 3 rushes for 10 yards. The problem with McKissick is he's such a gadget player. When they bring him in, you know it's either going to be a pass or a run to the outside, because every time they've tried to run him up the middle, since he started, you know, suiting up for games, it's been like he has no power. He can't run through an arm tackle inside. So he's very gadget player-y. But his, you know, three rushes for 10 yards, that's you know, that's about the same as the other two guys, especially when you consider the fact that McKissick had a 10-yard run. So the other two rushes combined for 0 yards. So I just don't see giving him running opportunities as something which is going to generate a lot more consistency on offense. And the Seahawks have kind of agreed, as you've noticed, that Tyler Lockett, of all people, has been getting a lot of running opportunities the last couple games. He had 3 in this game for 15 yards. That's
it seemed to me, though, Keith, that in retrospect, looking back at those, that at least 2 of those were to set up that flea flicker play.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to get opposing defenses to
move,
be careful, right, and watch the edges, because you got a guy with Lockett speed coming around the edge or McKissick speed coming around the edge. They are looking for that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, that flea flicker touchdown was fun.
Yeah, let's talk about that for half a second. I totally agreed with the call. I mean, you could predict that call right at the very beginning of that. Now, I understand that why the Giants would be upset at that. I mean, if I was the Seahawks and that happened to me, I'd be upset with that too, especially if my guy came down with it in the end. But when you have to take a look at the rules and the way that the play is came out, it was a catch first and then a kind of a simultaneously coming down with it as both players' feet hit the ground and then started to go to the ground. So that's a completed play, and at that point that's when you have to rule it, and at that point they were still simultaneous possession. That's a touchdown. That's it.
The
play is over at that moment. It doesn't matter what happens after that. You know, they argue that he stepped out of bounds, you know, but that was after what I just described, you know, and then their player came out with it in the very end. But that's, you know, 10 seconds after the play's over.
Yeah, that's after the call's been made. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, you look at that. That was
a great play.
It was a great play. Richardson, it's another one of those weird deep throws by Wilson, because Richardson was 7 yards beyond the cornerback, and Wilson hung it up there just a little too long, and Collins was able to get back and in position. But, you know, Richardson stepped in front and, you know, went up for it, got the ball, and then, you know, but Collins had position, so he also got the ball. But part of the reason why that would have held up, even if it was reviewable, was that Richardson actually got his body in front of Collins. And so when you're looking at possession, it's not that Collins caught it and then Richardson got his hands on it, because then you'd say, well, possession was first. Richardson was in front, so his hands got to the ball.
Okay, so that description doesn't fit the Golden Tate fail Mary call a few years back, where the defensive back was able to get his body in front, and and as they were coming to the ground, Tate was reaching around the defender to have his hands on the ball. So how do you explain that then?
Well, the difference with that call, one, I mean, that's the reason why it's called the Fail Mary, and it's a famous play, because you know, most people are convinced that the referees got the call wrong. I actually don't think so, and
I agree.
If you look at any of the angles that are often shown, man, the common description, it looks like Jennings got the ball first and then Tate got it. But if you look at, there's an end zone angle, which was not part of the broadcast, but it was filmed by the local station. I believe it was Q13, you know, the Fox affiliate. Keith,
exactly.
And you see Jennings go up to get the ball, and he kind of gets his hands on it, and his left hand comes off. And so he's got one hand near the ball, and Tate's got a hold of it. And then his left arm is just flailing around, and then finally he grabs onto Tate's bicep. And that's as closest as his left hand ever gets to the ball. And Jennings never actually had possession. And so that's why I think in that particular case, you had to give it to Tate and the Seahawks. But from all the other camera angles,
right,
I can see why everyone is like, wow, that, you know,
and you couldn't have made that call live. I mean, realistically, I don't think that really had to be slowed down and really looked at. And it still wasn't clear. I mean, you had to go with the call on the field, and that's really what it came down to. Is it was called a touchdown on the field, and that was the only reason that call stayed that way. If it would have been called an interception, it probably would have stayed as an interception with the play replays that they had at the time.
Yeah, because like I said, it's the only one where I think that it's definitive. Is that one which was not part of the broadcast, so it wasn't part of the replay system, and it wasn't part of any of the national narrative or, you know, coverage of the game, because it was just filmed by one of the local guys.
Funny, Keith, I had on the sideline. I had that still image from that Q13 video of the moment that it showed Tate having possession. You know, and it's just one of those things that, you know, everyone's going to argue a different way because nobody has ever really seen that or didn't really pay attention to it at the time. So anyway, a couple more players I want to talk about really quick. Doug Baldwin. What do you think of Doug Baldwin?
Baldwin had a massive game. He had 9 catches for 92 yards in this game. And the key thing was that I think 7 of those catches came on third down, and he turned 6 of those 7 third down catches into first downs.
Well, he had a touchdown out of that too, but he had that 63-yard overthrow by Wilson that would have added another touchdown. I mean, that would have been 10 catches for 150 yards.
Yeah, I mean, that was the type of game he had. And it was... I keep saying this, and I keep saying it, and I keep saying it, and I hope people understand just how phenomenal he is. If you go back and watch him play, watch what he does at the line of scrimmage.
This is crazy.
To get, because the team will come up and they'll press him. He'll win that 62-yard route. He won it at the line of scrimmage because his release off the line is so good. It's special. I mean, it is really, really fun to watch. And as a guy who watches a lot of film or whatever, I'm like, other than maybe Antonio Brown, who does a lot of the same things, but he does it a little bit faster, I don't think there's any receiver in the NFL that is that good at the line of scrimmage as Doug Baldwin. He is so much fun.
Yeah, no, he's a special player, special talent. And he passed, he had a couple of records that, franchise records that he either tied or passed this week too on those catches. So I think one was a touchdown total for career in Seattle. I think he's now in who did he pass? Gosh, I'm losing my mind. Is it Bobby Engram that he passed? I think maybe.
Yeah, I think he's in that
like third place or something all time, something like that.
If he continues to play in Seattle for his entire career, and especially if Seattle becomes a little more pass friendly at some point, he's going to be one of those guys that's
second only to Largent.
Yeah, he's gonna get close enough to Largent to where we're gonna be like,
does he belong in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, because he's gonna just keep inching closer.
Especially if we get another Super Bowl win, there's a lot of players on the bubble like that, where they'll have 2 Super Bowl wins, and then you start racking up the stats. Pretty soon, those players start talking about 4 or 5 players instead of, you know, 2 or 3 players that are locks for the Hall of Fame. You know, guys like Wilson that are, you know, have a trajectory of Hall of Fame. But if you put 2 Super Bowl wins in there and another Super Bowl appearance, and then he starts racking up some stats, he's in the conversation. Obviously, Sherman and Thomas are there in the conversation. Guys like Chancellor that have really impacted the way the strong safety is played in the NFL. He's got 2 Super Bowl wins and another appearance, plus, you know, just the reputation alone.
Bobby Wagner.
Another guy you can fit in there. And then you throw Doug Baldwin in there like that.
Pete Carroll.
Not
a player, but
yeah, no doubt.
But just his impact. When you have multiple teams coming out and saying, we're going to start running Seattle's defense, like the 49ers did.
Right.
I mean, that just tells you the impact that he's had from a coaching standpoint. So this is a special time to be a Seahawks fan. And let's face it, we deserve it. We lived through the 90s.
Yeah, and the 80s and the 70s. I did. You know, it is a great time. And, you know, you can and we do nitpick at the things that are not perfect, and look at the record at 4-2 and nitpick a little bit. But you're right. I mean, this is a special team, special coach, special players all the way around. We have a chance every year to put ourselves in a position to win, not only just win games, but win playoff games. And there's a lot of when you look at when you look at all the teams that say ESPN or HawkBlogger or whatever has in their top 32 teams, right? And they rank them.
Yeah, all the power rankings.
Right, the power rankings. And you look at the teams that are at the top of those rankings, let's say the top 10. You know, all but two of those teams are pretty much interchangeable. And then there's New England and Seattle that have been there year in, year out for the last 5 years. You know,
and I would say, and you threw in Green Bay in that.
Green Bay a little bit, but even less, I think even less so.
Yeah. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is hurt, so you don't have to include them now, but they're a team that's there every year. But yeah, it's Green Bay, it's Seattle, it's New England, maybe Denver, although they're having kind of a down year now, but
right.
There isn't this. There's kind of the upper class of the NFL, and the Seahawks are definitely in that. And that is
awesome. Nice place to
special.
Be
special. And it's fun because we are used to not being in that position.
One more player, Jaron Reed. I think he had a great game.
He had a tremendous game. Now people are going to look and they go, oh, well, he was the one who caused the fumble, that Frank Clark recovered that kind of ended the game. But he had a great game on top of that, just getting pressure. I mean,
seven tackles, two tackles for loss, that sack that forced the fumble.
Yep.
And he was in there quite a bit, disrupting the throwing lanes and the pocket and all that good stuff.
Well, and he had I think it was a screen pass that he sniffed out as a defensive tackle and just started upfield, saw what was going on. You could see him just plant his foot to follow the running back. And as soon as Darkwa caught it, he just got clobbered from behind by a 330-pound nose tackle. And when you see a guy like move like that and just do those little things, it, you know, it makes it really hard on the opposing team. Jaron Reed was a big reason to why the Giants were not able to ever get anything going, especially in the ground game.
And the Giants, yeah, exactly, Keith. The Giants came in to this game with 300 yards combined rushing in the two previous games, and Seattle allowed 46 yards and zero runs over 9 yards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, and then you combine that with what we did to the passing game. That's crazy. That's a complete game by your defense.
So Eli Manning was under 50% passing, 19 of 39, under 50%, only 134 yards. And most of those came in garbage time at the end of the game.
Well, if you take a look at the third and fourth quarter when New York was trying to come back, pass after pass after pass was thrown into coverage. Like, he didn't have any real open wide receivers, and the passes he did complete were tackled right away. I mean, the yards after catch, I don't know the stats, but the yards after catch in this game had to be close to, you know, none or 1 yard or 2 yards at the most.
Yeah, there was one catch and run by the tight end Ingram where he had a lot of yards after catching it, and it was at the end of the game in garbage time. Other than that, yeah, the defense was able to just get up and get their stops.
So one more player I wanted to mention before we move on to the to our next game. What in the heck is going on with Tanner McAvoy this year? And let me ask you this. The play has been so bad. Special teams play at receiver, et cetera. I mean, maybe not special teams completely, but he's made some bonehead plays. It's such a big regression. It's like falling off a cliff. So what do you think? And are they still interested in keeping him around? And I mean, are there any other receivers on our practice squad that might be able to come up and take his spot and be more effective?
Well, I'm not sure it's a regression so much as it is a larger role. We're seeing him in more situations, playing more, and so therefore we're seeing more mistakes. When he, like last year, we only saw him a couple of plays a game, and when he would make a big play on those couple of plays a game, we're like, wow, this guy's got some talent. Now we're seeing him more, and it hasn't been a good look for him. So I don't know whether it's truly a regression or just a lack of development. They like what he does in special teams. They like his height. Sorry about all the coughing, by the way. They like his height. They like his speed. They like the things he does as a gunner and his ability to come up. And he almost blocked a punt in this game. And then, unfortunately, he got kicked in the head. And that led to giving the Giants a first down because of running into the kicker. But,
I would say that he's only one or two plays away, a big plays away, like nice completions, touchdown receptions, from getting back in favor because, mm-hmm. He doesn't have too much of a role, but to me, all those kind of plays stand out more because he really hasn't had a lot of successes this year to counteract those sorts of issues. So I just curious what you thought.
The one guy they have on the practice squad at receiver is David Moore, who was the 7th round pick, and he looked really good in the preseason.
He did.
As a guy. But I just think that McAvoy offers them those.
He does.
That special teams play. And for the 5th receiver on a team, a guy they don't need a lot from, because Darvo stepped up really big the last
week. I can tell you what, if they don't re-sign Jimmy Graham, they're going to need a big style target. You could almost be an H-back kind of a guy, kind of a role for him. So moving towards the Houston Texans game, Texans come in to the matchup with a record of 3-3. Keith, they're in third place in the AFC South. They have big wins against the Bengals, Titans, and Browns, and losses against the Jaguars, Patriots, and Chiefs. And in retrospect, all of that seems to line up and make sense. I mean, the Chiefs and the Patriots and the Jaguars have really good teams. Bengals, Titans, and Browns, you could argue the Titans are a 50-50 team, but they went and took care of business there. Who are the Texans, and what should we expect from their rookie phenom quarterback, Deshaun Watson, their 12th overall pick in the 2017 draft?
I'm going to tell you, I was surprised that Watson fell to the 10th or the 12th pick. I just don't understand what the people didn't like about him. I get he doesn't have the biggest arm, he doesn't have a lot of ball velocity, but it's well above that minimum threshold. But everything else he does, everything he's able to do was high quality. I mean, he was the best quarterback in this draft class, in my opinion. And he fell to the 12th pick, and then the Texans were smart to go get him. And it is one of those things where he is a guy that he is a rookie. He'll make rookie mistakes, but he's supremely talented. He throws well on the move. He does a lot of the little things that you want in that type of offense that will make it good, because they're an outside zone running team, and he can peel off and throw, on a bootleg coming the other way, which keeps defenders at home and that kind of stuff. So he does a lot of those things that really help the outside zone running game.
Yeah, the thing with Houston for me on their offense would be consistency for a duration of an entire game against the Seahawks, which is going to be a real challenge for Watson. Rookies have a really hard time against Seattle. Any quarterback is going to have a hard time against Seattle, but especially a rookie with the way that Seattle just smothers wide receivers. I don't know. I could see a few sacks in this game, I think, just coverage sacks. But we do need to pay attention to Watson. He leads the NFL this year in 15 touchdowns, despite not starting in week one and not throwing for a score in week two. So the guy's been prolific, and he's got plenty of playmakers around him.
He's got a lot of weapons there.
Yeah, Hopkins, Will Fuller, Lamar Miller, Ellington, Ryan Griffin, Donta Foreman, who I really liked in the draft as a running back, as a kind of a power back. and he's giving them about 70 yards a game. So they kind of have a running tandem there. They do run the zone, which we are familiar with. So maybe, hopefully that'll help our defense out a little bit. But I still think that we force them into mistakes as the game wears on.
Yeah, especially if the Seahawks can do something they haven't done all year, and that's score in the first half. And make it so that way,
yeah,
Houston can't just sit back and run and run and run and keep the score low and know that they don't have to go put up 30 points in this game.
Well, and that's going to be the key. That's going to be their mentality, I think, coming into the game, is playing down and dirty and low scoring and get themselves in a position to win at the end. I mean, that's what I would do. What can we expect Seattle's offense to face, Keith?
Well, see, the thing with Houston's defense is they've got some great players, and then they've got some weaknesses. They're not as strong in the secondary as other teams are, but they've got a pass rush that makes up for it. Now, J.J. Watt's hurt, and that is a big deal, because with him and Clowney both coming, mm-hmm. That's something that the Seahawks just don't have the ability to stop.
But they look like they probably will be able to stop us versus the run. I mean, they really get a lot of penetration on run downs, mm-hmm. To blow up plays. That's kind of their thing, is they blow up run plays. And Seattle's been very susceptible to that. So I'm not sure if we're going to be able to establish the run or not in this game.
The Seahawks haven't established the run yet this year, so I'm not really concerned about that. They're going to try. They'll fail. And Russell Wilson will have to throw the team to victory, which that is what happens. That is the 2017 Seattle Seahawks. Is they try and run. They can't. Russell Wilson has to throw them to victory. And that's not necessarily a problem for me, because I think that you have an offense that can handle that. And so when I look at the way that this game is going to go, I mean, I don't see a lot of rushing yards really by the Seahawks in any game. But in this game, I don't see a lot at all. So if you're going to create rushing yards, it's going to be through getting McKissick on the outside. It's going to be the end arounds to Tyler Lockett. You cannot lean on Thomas Rawls and Eddie Lacy and expect them to have a lot of success running up the middle.
Yeah. The only thing you could do against an aggressive run defense team is to use that aggression against them. And the zone blocking scheme is kind of designed to do that. And they could definitely create some lanes using that aggression. And we'll see. I mean, I think you're right, though. The game plan has got to be on the arm of Russell Wilson. I mean, it just is. And but, you know, let me ask you this. At the beginning of the year, this is one of those home games that we had on the schedule where you were a bit concerned. You thought that Houston would be possibly good enough to steal mm-hmm. this game. Do you still feel that way?
I do. They're a good roster. I mean, they've got a lot of weapons on offense. They have a quarterback that's not going to make a lot of dumb mistakes. I just see, like, you know, the teams that beat the Seahawks do so with an offense where they can dink and dunk and you know, convert a lot of 5, 6, 7 yard throws underneath. And the Texans seem built to do that. You've got guys like Nuke Hopkins and Will Fuller that can stretch the defense out and create those spots underneath where they can do that. And they're just going to be able to extend drives and keep Seattle's offense off the field so they can't get in a rhythm and keep the defense on the field. And it's just going to be tough.
Yeah. I think conversely, you know, Seattle's going to rely on their defense to stop the run. They mm-hmm. wanted to stop the run in this so they can force again. And this is a reoccurring theme throughout the year and probably will be all year. So they can force the opposing team's quarterback to make plays. And the best unit on Seattle's team is their secondary. And their second best unit on their team is, you know, their defensive line and linebackers. You know, so, I mean, Seattle's defense is legit top two, top three in this league right now. And it's going to be hard for any team, to come in and move the ball against the Seahawks. And you're going to end up having to be perfect. I mean, it's one of those things that Seattle's going to require Houston to have 8 to 10 play drives sustained over the entire game. And when you do that against a team like Seattle, you're against a rookie quarterback, you're going to end up making mistakes. You just are. Mm-hmm. And those mistakes are going to result in turnovers. And those turnovers are going to what's going to be making the difference in this game to me. And special teams. I think the special teams for Houston is one of their poorer units overall, and I think we can take advantage of that. So yeah, I Seattle coming away with like a 27-13 victory.
Wow, so you think it's going to be a fairly easy win?
No, I don't think it's going to be easy, but I think we're going to pull away. This is, again, one of those games similar to New York, similar to every game we're in, really. With the first half, we kind of slog along, feel it out. There's not a lot of explosive plays on either team. In the second half, we take advantage of, and we wear them down, and we start to score, and our defense continues to shut them down.
Okay, well, I can see that. I'm thinking it's going to be a little closer. I think it's going to be more like 23-20. I think it's going to be, you know, one of those games that the Seahawks have to win it at the end, and they're a team that knows how to finish. So I just don't see the Seahawks being able to pull away because I don't think the offense is going to be able to have enough success to consistently move the ball against Houston's defense. I still don't trust the offensive line. And when I don't trust the offensive line, I don't believe they can keep having the success play after play after play where they can string drives together.
Yeah. It'll be, I mean, all games in the NFL are usually close. I mean, mm-hmm. statistically, like 70% of them are within 7 points or less.
Yep.
And so, but we're at home. We're on a three game win streak. We've mm-hmm. got some momentum. I think things are starting to come together for the offense. I mean, if you really take a look at that New York game, and that was a great game. Even though we didn't score a lot of points in the first half, we still put up 222 yards of total offense.
Yes, we did.
Russell Wilson is starting to really find his rhythm. He did have a few overthrows there, but they seem to be correctable. I mean, he's definitely proven it in the past that he can connect on those. And if they take some shots down the field in this game and connect on them, we could run away with this game. But I don't see that happening, but it could happen because I don't see their offense being able to move the ball too much on Seattle. I think if we turn them into a one-dimensional team, there's going to be a lot of three and outs or six play drives that result in us getting the ball back.
Yeah, I can definitely see it. You know, it's the thing is that the Seahawks have to win the field position battle. So they need enough out of the offense to continuously pin Houston deep where they have to go 80 yards or 90 yards to score. Because if yep. you're asking a team to go 80 or 90 yards to score, they're not going to score. They might get a couple first downs. They might string together a drive, but the drive will eventually bog down and they'll have to punt. So the Seahawks have to be able to do that. They need enough out of the offense that you're not giving Houston a short field over and over again.
Yeah. I just don't see Houston's defense being that dominant. I mean, they're dominant up front and then everything else is sort of marginal. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got Zach Cunningham, I think, as a rookie inside linebacker. He can play sideline to sideline. There's no question about it, but he's a rookie still learning the game.
Oh, and he'll make mistakes that hopefully the Seahawks will be able to
And like you said, their defensive backs are susceptible. I think Russell Wilson's going to be able to find targets and take advantage of this game. So, I mean, it's the NFL. Anything can happen. Mm-hmm. We got turnovers and bounce balls and all that good stuff to contend with, but I feel comfortable in this game. Probably slightly more comfortable than I did at the beginning of the season because I think our team's starting to build upon its successes, and I think that will continue. So, anything else, Keith, before we call it a show?
Let's call it a show before I start coughing some more and really turn this good. Into a problem. I don't want to make everyone sick by coughing on my
microphone. You're coughing and sneezing so much that people listening are going to catch
a cold. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, yep. Yeah. So let's go. thanks, everyone, for listening and joining us on the show today. You can follow Keith on Twitter at MyersNFL, Bills at NWSeahawk. You can find all the social media stuff on the links on our website at hawksplaybook.com. And listen to us and subscribe on Blog Talk Radio and iTunes and all the other apps out there. So have a great week. Enjoy the game on Sunday. And we will see y'all next week. Thanks again.
Hey, Hawks fans. Thanks for listening to the Hawks Playbook Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or Blog Talk Radio and listen to all of our shows on hawksplaybook.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hawks Playbook. Bill is at NWSeahawk, and Keith is at MyersNFL.